The Spotlight.
North Korea has made some major announcements. North Korea's President Kim Jong-un has said that building the nuclear force is the most important cause, adding that the new ICBM clearly proved to the world that North Korea is a full-fledged nuclear power and can stand against the supremacy of the U.S. What are the reasons for his announcements, and how will the U.S. react hearing that, especially since Kim Jong-un has said that North Korean scientists have made a wonderful leap forward in technology for mounting nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles? Just a few of the topics and issues we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Richard Brecker, anti-war activist, joins us from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, also joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, first to you. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, saying that his country aims to have the world's most powerful nuclear force. He said that while celebrating the launch of this new intercontinental ballistic missile at a ceremony which some were surprised to see his daughter. Not that it wasn't known how important nuclear weapons are to North Korea. Why do you think this is coming at this time and it being displayed in the way that it is?
Well, let's cast our minds back 4 years or so to the Donald Trump era, where actually Kim Jong-un and Trump were embracing each other, and actually there was a rapprochement going on. Trump had basically cut through all of the diplomatic nonsense that the State Department, it's almost like a firewall, really, with these bureaucrats at the deep state set up, and Trump had managed to cut through that. In order to literally sit down with Kim Jong-un in North Korea and say, look, listen, you know, we can get along, we can start to trust each other from the presidential level down, you know, and that has all, it seems, been falling apart. But in the backdrop to all of this, and I think we've got to just look at the nuclear weapons era after the Second World War, as the United States became initially the sole controller of nuclear weapons, and other countries then got on the nuclear bandwagon. Well, of course, it wasn't a bandwagon because they realized that this was the weapon of the future, and anybody who had this weapon would be able to intimidate, you know, not only other countries but their own population into going along with various plans to do with possible wars. And so if you go back to 1956, where the British were attacked in Egypt and the Americans refused to help us, I think that was the right thing to do, actually, because it was the end of the colonial era. But the Americans at that point really started to, on a plan for what was an attempt at world domination. And I think that we have to just be realistic about this. The Americans don't say this. They never say this in any official capacity.
Right.
But anyone that pays attention to world affairs knows that that's what the United States wants. And there's only one thing which will stop you being dominated by the United States, it seems. And other countries like Libya, etc., Iraq, etc., have realized realize this, and that is nuclear weapons are the only things the Americans understand. If you've got nuclear weapons, they won't attack you. But if you haven't, they may do, and at some point they probably will do. And so I think the Americans have actually made this situation for themselves by the combination of being the first major nuclear power, with Henry Kissinger putting the strategy forward to all this, and then also by having the unified command structure around the world, where the US military attempts to dominate every inch of the planet. This is, I think, what's created the reaction from Kim Jong-un and nothing else.
Well, taking a look at what our guest Tony Gosling said, Richard Becker, I mean, first of all, let's take a look at what this intercontinental ballistic missile is that Kim Jong-un is so raving about. It's called the Hwasong-17, dubbed a monster missile, believed to be capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. Now, given the fact that they are now in possession of this, what do you think the U.S. is actually thinking, or how should it react? Or at this point, is the fact that North Korea is capable of having and making this type of intercontinental ballistic missile mean that it's not even interested in any negotiations on its missile capabilities?
Yes. So I do think that they are interested, very interested in negotiations, but there have to be real negotiations. In 2018, there was the meeting in Singapore, which your other guest referenced, which looked like it could move toward, a breakthrough. But in Hanoi in 2019, that collapsed. The negotiations collapsed suddenly. And according to CNBC, the network here, it collapsed because Trump came into that meeting with a piece of paper and written in English and Korean and saying that North Korea should turn over its weapons and its weapons-grade fuel, to the United States. And that was it. That was the end of the agreement. Now, that was really, we believe, Bolton and Pompeo. Bolton's been a longtime advocate of exterminating North Korea altogether. He was asked once what his policy was in regard to North Korea, and he said, no North Korea. So you had those elements take over. And whereas in 2018, there was an agreement to limit or halt testing on the part of North Korea if there was also an end to the so-called war games, which aren't really war games at all, by the U.S. and South Korea simulating invasions of North Korea. And this year, they were back at a very high level. That was in August. And they openly stated, the U.S. commanders openly stated that part of those military maneuvers, those war games, and you never know if they're games until they're over, but part of them was the assassination of Kim Jong-un, the leader of the country. The New York Times said he might have taken it personally. Well, no kidding. if the most powerful military in the world said, we're rehearsing to kill you, or to assassinate you and to destroy your government, well, of course, you have to understand what that really means. So that's the reality of the situation, is that what was at one time appeared to be a promising steps toward normalization of relations, an end to the war. There has never been an end to the Korean War, the U.S.-Korea War. It's an armistice agreement. And the North Koreans very much want an end to this status of war. They want a peace agreement with the United States, and they want a lifting of the economic sanctions, which have done so much damage to North Korea and the people of North Korea, as they have to so many other countries in the world.
I'm going to ask you the same question, Tony Gosling. I mean, we could take a look at the previous attempts that were made by the U.S. And North Korea in terms of trying to reach some kind of a deal. But aren't we looking at a new landscape now? I mean, we're looking at a landscape wherein Russia is somewhat disconnected from the West, in a matter of speaking. They're not really interested in the West, and they're shifted, really aligning themselves with China. Do you think North Korea is still very much interested in wanting some kind of a deal with the U.S. in particular for sanctions to be lifted, given the fact that, I'm guessing that China is one way or another backing North Korea?
Well, it's a very important point, yes. I mean, in a way, North Korea is just a kind of policy maneuver of China that it can do at arm's length. So it can, you know, what they're doing through, I think, in North Korea is much of the things that the Chinese would like to say and like to do, but the Chinese are far, far more sensible, and they're trying to keep a good diplomatic relationship with the United States. But the U.S. has caused so much trouble for itself by throwing its weight around and trying to, well, I mean, what they've done is they've used this economic warfare for the last 20 years to bully and badger various countries around the world. And what's been the result? Well, it's meant that the US is not trading with so many countries now that actually the US economy itself is collapsing. And the Chinese are doing very well out of this. I mean, they've got a very well-oiled, and they've got actually quite a well-organized state in China, whereas the state in the U.S. and much of Western Europe is starting to collapse. The big corporations taking over, the government, you know, basically finding it almost impossible to get in tax revenue because it's so weak. And so I think it's quite clear that, yes, the North Koreans do want to negotiate with the United States. But the thing is, as Vladimir Putin said, I think it was about 8 months, maybe a little bit longer ago now, the beginning of 2022, I heard him say something in one of his speeches along the lines of, well, the United States is not deal ready. This is a great expression because he's saying we can sit at the table with them all day, but we cannot actually get them to make a deal that they'll stick to. And they might even say something, but then they'll go away and they'll say, oh, we're very sorry, but our diplomats back in Washington have told us that we can't do this. So he's saying that to a certain extent, although they're always willing to sit down and talk to the United States, they're finding that they're basically banging their heads against a brick wall. And that is because the deep state in the U.S. is in free fall, rather like the last days of Rome, when the Roman Empire was so corrupt on the inside that the various machines of diplomacy stopped working for the Romans. And, of course, their empire then stopped working. And I think we're seeing a similar sort of collapse with the US now. Many people would love to do deals with the United States, sensible, mature, adult deals, which would see all their people's successful growth of trade in the future, trusting relationships. Mm-hmm. But we've got a deep state in the US that doesn't want that to happen because it's afraid of its own position. You know, what we've seen is that, you know, there's various problems at the center of the US, not least of which has been revealed by the Epstein scandal. And these people are worried that if law and order breaks out in the international community, that the United States, the leaders of the deep state in the United States, the organized criminals, basically, may be just going to jail or worse, maybe being executed. So they're fighting a rear guard action, which is affecting their relationship with the entire world.
This is a very curious situation, Richard Becker, when you take a look at the landscape in that part of the world in terms of what the U.S. is doing. And my question to you is whether the U.S. does not want tensions to decrease. Now, when I say that, I mean the U.S. is busy trying to militarize. I shouldn't say trying to militarize the region. It's selling arms to the countries in that region, especially to the ones that are allied to it. Now, one of the main reasons it's doing that is, aside from North Korea, is the ultimate goal of China, because we know obviously the U.S. has a focus on China. And it does not want tensions then to be reduced because it could continue with these arms sales like it did with Japan. Japan said that I'm going to quadruple my defense spending. I'm going to buy all these missiles, especially howitzers, I think, which reach deep inside mainland China. It wants to keep that at that level because it's going to somewhat be preparing not only itself, but its allies in the region to confront China ultimately. Do you think that that's the correct way of looking at it?
Well, I think that there's no question that the pivot to Asia, as it was called, is aimed first and foremost at China. But North Korea also has an important role now, and the relations between them are strong, it appears, as they are between North Korea and Russia. And Russia and China, but particularly China, is the main target of the pivot to Asia and this huge buildup, which has seen vast deployment of U.S. military forces, increased military forces. There were already vast forces there. in the Indo-Pac Command, as they call it, the Pacific Command, and this is an important factor in this. And the military buildup in Japan is also, it's also worth noting. Korea used to be was for decades a colony of Japan, and now the right wing and the militarists in Japan, they find it intolerable that they don't have nuclear weapons when their former colony does. North Korea being half of what that former colony was, and that's a big issue in Japan among the right wing. And if the as the this process continues, the military buildup on the part of and nuclear buildup on the part of Korea, the pressures inside Japan grow for Japan to become also a nuclear power. The U.S. does not want Japan to become a nuclear power. It wants Japan to continue to be subordinate to the United States. And Japan is occupied. The occupation of Japan has never ended since the end of World War II. Tens of thousands of troops are all over Japan and Okinawa, as well as other bases in the area, but particularly Japan and Okinawa are key bases for the U.S. Military strategy in regard to Asia and its strategy of domination of Asia and global domination.
That's a very good point that you're making there. Since you mentioned China and Russia, Tony Gosling, I'm looking at a couple of important points there on China. One of them, which involves Russia also, is that the U.S. says that both Russia and China have the ability to have leverage on North Korea to stop them from conducting these tests, and it wants to see Russia and China do that. It's not as if you've been hosting Russia and China in such a cordial, warm manner, you know, right. when you then come out and make a, I don't want to say demand, but asking both of them to do that. Why should Russia and China do that for the U.S.?
Well, they're not going to, I don't think, because actually what Kim Jong-un is doing is serving a very useful purpose, particularly for the Chinese. I mean, he is saber-rattling for the Chinese, I think, it's fair to say. The Chinese would much rather not be, you know, going for any confrontation. And obviously, at the moment, there are all sorts of domestic problems the Chinese have got to cope with demonstrations against the continued lockdowns and this sort of thing going on within China. It's serving, I think, a useful purpose, and it's very unlikely. When I say a useful purpose, I mean countering the bullying of the United States, effectively, and saying, well, look, you know, if you can play at this game of making nuclear threats, so can we. And although the United States isn't necessarily making those on CNN, what it's doing is it's moving its forces closer to China, and it's surrounding China. It's threatening to blockade China, basically, by its military manoeuvres. But I think that where the solutions might come to all of this, we need to look closely at there are high-level connections between the United States and China, which very rarely get talked about. There was a very good discussion about all this recently by James Corbett and Whitney Webb, two very good freelance journalists who I'm sure some of your viewers will know, at looking at the connections between the two. Now, this is a kind of deep state connection between the US and China. And so I think if there is going to be any dropping of these tensions, and of course, if that happens, that what we'll see is less saber-rattling from Kim Jong-un and less saber-rattling from the United States, maybe even some US troops going home from places like Japan we were just hearing about, and in other places in the Pacific. And that's where this should start. But of course, there is also a very important party in all of this, and that is the arms lobby. The arms lobby are pushing so much of US policy. They are very, very close to, obviously, the military, the State Department, and the US government. And they are the people, I think, that are pushing all these saber-rattling and the tension, because they will simply make money out of any kind of conflict. Although, you know, many people think, well, we don't want a war. Why does anyone want a war? The arms lobby love wars. I hate to tell you, but they do, because they make a fantastic amount of money at it. And right. In the United States, they have the ear of Congress. They have the ear of President Biden. And the sorts of fear-mongering that the arms lobby come out with, but, I'm afraid, is the talk of the president and other people that talking about China and North Korea as a big threat, actually pushing their armed forces closer to these countries. And that is actually the arms lobby speaking. It's not the democratic people of the United States by any means.
Well, but to what degree is this, U.S. military going to go, even though they're interested, as our guest there said, the arms lobby is interested in these conflicts when we're talking about nuclear conflicts? I mean, Richard Becker, taking a look at what's happening in Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia. So you have a nuclear armed country there that the U.S. and Russia have exchanged statements amongst each other, with Russia at least proposing the idea of perhaps the use of nuclear weapons, even though it has said on many occasions that it's not going to do that. Or when it comes to the case of North Korea, of which the U.S. has also, in reaction, for example, gone ahead and has its B-52 bombers, for example, flying over. Even China itself has nuclear bombs. And also looking at the region in West Asia, or the Middle East, as some call it, its ally, Israel, that has nuclear bombs. I mean, these are tensions around the world involving nuclear weapons. And the common denominator here is the U.S.
That's right. And, you know, it's not that China wants to rule the world or North Korea wants to rule. That's not true. But it is true that the United States wants to rule the world. I mean, it's the policy, the national security strategy changed in 2018 to one of away from the war on terrorism, so-called, to major party competition or major party conflict. It's clear what that means. You know, and we have to remember when in the longer term context, that it was in February, I believe, of 2002 that Bush gave his infamous speech and the State of the Union, and it talked about the axis of evil. And it was a ridiculous speech, but very threatening to those who were the target, mainly the axis of evil being Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Iran and Iraq had had a war, an eight-year war with each other. They weren't exactly allies, and neither were allies. They might have friendly relations, but not allies with North Korea. And then what happened? Iraq was destroyed. Its state destroyed, and it remains destroyed today by the U.S. And then we have Libya was persuaded to give up its weapons programs, turn them over to the U.S., and then Libya was destroyed. So it was after the destruction of Iraq and the second Iraq war, U.S.-Iraq war, that North Korea resolutely set out that we're going to have a nuclear program, we're going to have nuclear weapons. They had been doing research before, but that really triggered the decision to go forward, we believe. And that is understandable. If you can't be able to respond to your adversary and your adversary is threatening your existence, well, you have a big problem. And so, you know, I think that's the context we have to see this in, is that it has been, as you said, the common denominator being the U.S. and its vast nuclear weapons program. I should also add, North Korea probably has 40 nuclear weapons at this point, maybe a little bit more than that. They can develop 6 or 7 a year. The United States has over 6,000 nuclear weapons and can destroy the entire planet with its nuclear arsenal in case of war. And that's where the great threat comes from in terms of nuclear weapons and what they can do to humanity and to the world that we live in.
Indeed. And that's something that obviously is taken notes with countries that the U.S. accuses of pursuing nuclear weapons, which one of them could be Iran, that is not trying to, in any shape or form, pursue a nuclear weapon, but is going after a civilian nuclear program. Now, Tony Gustin, in closing, you know, when you talk about the U.S. wanting to be a superpower in pretty much all over the world, as our guest there said, and I think you mentioned that in some sense, why is the U.S. on that track? It's not successful. It can't even control. I just looked it up real quick, a Google search in Washington, D.C., where it has the highest crime rate. If you can't control your own state, how are you going to control the world?
Well, we have exactly the same problem here in the UK. The government has made a total mess of domestic policy. We've got poverty going through the roof, homelessness going through the roof. And so what they always do is they focus on foreign policy. This is just a distraction, effectively, from the complete failures of them to run their own economies. And, you know, slapping the biggest example is the oil companies holding the government in Europe and the United States to ransom, jacking up energy prices, which makes nuclear power actually more viable and just about viable, as they're price fixing upwards all of the fossil fuels, saying they're doing something green, but what they're really doing is just helping the nuclear industry. And so I think, well, you know, you have to also remember that I think it was the Grey Zone, one of these websites recently, is alleging that actually Zelensky in Ukraine has been helping the North Koreans over the years to get their nuclear weapons program. Because, of course, the Ukrainians had a lot of ex-Russian
nuclear weapons. We're just fresh out of time. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist. Thank you. Richard Becker, anti-war activist, Answer Coalition from San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next Spotlight, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Fama lana min shafi'in.
So now we have no intercessors.
ولا صديق حميم
and not a devoted friend
فلو أن لنا كرة فنكون من المؤمنين
then if we only had a return to the world and could be of the believers
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we have reached the 102nd verse of Surah Al-Shu'ara to be discussed. The verse says, فَلَوْ أَنَّ لَنَا كَرَّةً فَنَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ Now, then we have no intercessors, they said previously. We have no single intimate friend, and now they say, فَلَوْ أَنَّ لَنَا كَرَّةً. If we only had a chance of return, فَنَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. We would be from among the believers. This is what the sinners, what the followers and worshippers of false idols, what the polytheists will claim on that day. But the Holy Quran has said elsewhere in the other verses that this is only merely a claim that will not happen even if we give them another chance. Anyway, through this verse, the Holy Quran implies that soon these sinners will understand this fact, that neither any regret is helpful there in the fire of hell, nor hereafter is the place of action and compensation. And that is why they desire to come back to this world. They realize that it is only whatever they had brought with them that counts and nothing else. So the verse says, فَلَوْ أَنَّ لَنَا كَرَّةً فَنَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. If we only had a chance of return, we would be from among the believers. It is true that they have got a belief in that world and on that day, but this belief is a kind of compulsory belief. That kind of belief is effective and constructive, which is voluntarily happening, which is happening in this world when there is chance. A belief that becomes the source of guidance and righteous deeds. Those righteous deeds and faith that are the conditions of being interceded for on the day of hereafter.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, as this verse of the Holy Quran says, the polytheists and the sinners believe that if they had the chance to return to this world, they would be from among the believers. Of course, now they have understood that they do not have any intercessors, فَمَا لَنَا مِنْ شَافِعِينَ. They do not have any close intimate friends, وَلَا صَدِيقٍ حَمِيمٍ. And that's why they claim to be from among the believers. They have realized that faith, being from among the believers of the Lord of the universe, is the condition, one of the conditions, of course, of receiving that intercession on that day. This is what these verses are explicitly telling us when we put them right next to each other. They know they do not have any intercessors. Now they claim to return to the world and do the righteous deeds and be from among the believers. They have realized that being a believer is one of the conditions of receiving this intercession. Yet, this desire does not solve any problem for them, and the divine way of treatment does not let anyone come back to this world. They themselves know this fact too, and the Arabic word if is its evidence in this verse. لو أن لنا كرة. This لو and if is the kind of article used when you do not have the hope for the content afterwards to happen. And this is really interesting because one of the names of the day of hereafter is يوم الحسرة. It is the day of envy. It is the day of yearning for the things you could have done previously, but you haven't. But you haven't brought with you. That's why they say لو أن لنا كرة. And they have understood that they do not have the condition to be interceded for. They are not from among the believers. And they have understood that the ones they befriended in the world are not useful to them. Their friends were from among the unbelievers, and that's why they do not get any help from their close, intimate friends. They do not have any close friends because the true intimate friends, as the Holy Quran announces, is the one who has the righteous deeds and is from among the believers. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Tens of thousands of activists from Imran Khan's PTI party, who came from all across Pakistan, chanted anti-government slogans demanding immediate elections, accusing the government for what they called following US-backed policies. The protesters held the ruling party responsible for the current economic crisis. They said Imran Khan is the only leader who could bring political and economic stability to Pakistan.
Our leader Imran Khan is fighting with the corrupt mafia who was brought by the US. Our struggle is for the rule of law in the country, and that is only possible when Imran Khan will be in power.
Having survived an assassination attempt during his anti-government march on the 3rd of November, former Prime Minister Imran Khan joined the protesters in person for the first time in 3 weeks amid stringent security. Khan told his supporters that although his life is under threat, he will continue his political struggle until his demands are met.
This imported government was brought through a U.S. conspiracy for corruption purposes. We will not accept this puppet regime and we will fight till the end for fresh polls. We will dissolve our provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces in days to come.
While calling Khan's long march a flop show, the government says that it will complete its constitutional term and the electoral process will be held at its scheduled time. Imran Khan's supporters say the recent massive mass rallies indicate Imran Khan's increasing popularity in his political domain. However, it is highly believed that his party will face tough political competition if the scheduled general elections are held according to the government's plan. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is not a lecture, but a picket line. Lecturers, librarians, and researchers are out here as part of a massive strike across the country. 150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualised, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualised.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for a similar reason. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purza, London.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions. But so far, I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months. World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems, and the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy, but we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
The U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than 2 decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The EU is currently paying more for gas than any other region in the world. The European Commission had proposed to cap natural gas prices at €275 per megawatt hour. The idea was totally rubbished by the bloc's energy ministers at a meeting on Thursday.
A ceiling between €150 and €200 is a realistic ceiling, and this could help us reduce gas prices and therefore reduce electricity prices.
But any sort of a cap could result in gas suppliers moving their tankers to other parts of the world where there is no cap, like Asia.
If we really see that this mechanism is designed in the way that that we will lose LNG cargoes to other international markets, then we can suspend it.
As things stand in the EU, there is no guarantee of a manageable gas price or even a gas supply for 2023.
If we cannot keep our economy running, we will not be able to support Ukraine, and we must do everything to avoid such scenario.
Those representing small to medium-sized businesses are looking for EU support amid high inflation and growing interest rates.
If we not want to fight unemployment and youth unemployment, we need to take care about the growth and competitiveness of European SMEs.
A debate in the European Parliament this week on promoting stability in the Middle East heard that the initiative would help ensure energy security for the EU. However, one lawmaker raised the West's previous actions in the region.
leaving broken countries, hobbled economies, violence, trauma and permanent conflict. And at the end of that, we stroke our chins, pretend we've nothing to do about it and ask how we are going to promote stability in the region. You have got to be joking.
EU energy ministers will meet again on the 13th of December to try and reach agreement on the vital question of 2023 gas supplies. Analysts say this crisis best illustrates how sanctions against Russia have backfired. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The recent decision by Italy to close its ports to the Ocean Viking vessel carrying 234 refugees has been slated in the European Parliament. The vessel, operated by a charity, was eventually allowed to dock in France.
How cynical is it that NGOs filling this gap and saving lives are criminalised, whereas the states violating their obligation enjoy impunity?
Asylum applications have increased by 60% in the EU during the past 12 months. That figure is separate from those arriving from Ukraine. In fact, the 27 EU nations are providing maximum support to Ukrainians, while those from other countries are often forced to sleep on the streets.
How dare so many of you define yourself as Christians and repeat that you are defending Christian values when your ideas and your actions are proof of the opposite.
In the Mediterranean alone, 2,000 refugees have drowned so far this year, according to the International Organization for Migration. The message seems to be, if you're not one of the 4 million Ukrainians who have arrived in the EU in recent months, you're not welcome. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen and Libya. Apparently, the far right is flourishing in the EU due to the bloc's neglect of refugees.
How did Lega get big? How did the AfD get big? How did Marine Le Pen get big? It's all by capitalising on the fears of migration.
The ascent of the extreme right in the EU is certainly bad news for asylum seekers, according to analysts.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
EU Home Affairs ministers will hold an emergency meeting on the refugee crisis this Friday. There's a great deal of scepticism that anything will be achieved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdollahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdollahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now, Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
On Tuesday, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni unveiled Italy's 2023 draft budget bill during a press conference held at the government building. The package features a $35 billion spending plan and fiscal policies focusing mainly on supporting families, self-employed workers and those on low incomes.
Due grandi priorità.
There are two big priorities, growth, which means safeguarding our production system, and social justice, which means focusing on families and on people on low incomes. This budget is the product of political choices, as is normal for a political government.
About two-thirds of the 35 billion euro budget bill will be allocated to measures aimed at helping struggling families and businesses with the cost of living emergency. Power bills have skyrocketed amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war, while Italy's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
Buying food, fuel, paying power bills, it's very difficult. We are struggling to make ends meet, and we expect this government to help us.
The government must ease tax pressure. We can't go on this way anymore. And the war in Ukraine should be stopped. All problems began with the conflict.
A flat tax rate on incomes of up to 85,000 euros for professionals and individual businesses is to be introduced, while the controversial citizenship wage basic income introduced by the Five Star Movement in 2018 is set to be reduced. Also, the pension system will be reformed to allow early retirement. The cabinet also discussed the 2013 Euratom directive, which deals with civilians being exposed to ionizing radiations. Euratom is the European Atomic Energy Community, which was set up in the late 50s to shape Europe's nuclear energy market. The draft budget bill will now be sent to Brussels for approval before it is passed. Max Civili, Rome.
People have gathered to receive winter fuel in form of coal and wood distributed by Iranian embassy in Kabul to warm the cold days of their lives. Najiba and Tahira, who take care of their children all alone, cry out the problems of the cold winter.
I don't have a supporter and my husband has passed away. It's five of us in my family, all of whom are jobless. Currently, we live in a rental house. We could really use such aids and hope it continues, especially in winters.
It is a hard winter, especially for us who don't have the primary needs of our lives. I have small children. I literally don't have anything to warm my home. I work hard to feed my seven family members, but still can't meet our needs.
Almost all who receive relief aids are widows and orphans, most of whom burn plastic, tires, and other waste materials to warm their houses and sometimes cook food. The happiness is noticeable as these widows can provide a warm home for their orphans. The number of these families can reach up to 1,000.
Well, we are prepared to distribute fuel to 1,000 families. The fuel is firewood and coal. We give each family a package of almost 200 kilograms. It isn't much, but it could be enough for almost a month. We are hoping to be able to continue such activities in the coming months also.
With the arrival of winter, concerns about the situation of the people of Afghanistan have intensified. The arrival of winter and warming houses has added to the daily problems of the poor in Afghanistan. Although aid is being provided to some people, there are still many who spend their nights in cold weather. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
in the limelight.
The fabricated regime of Israel has intensified its brutalities against Palestinians in the month of November. The reports that the Zionist regime has extended administrative detention of a Palestinian cancer-stricken prisoner. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The Zionist regime is keeping a cancer-stricken Palestinian man in administrative detention despite his urgent need for medical attention," the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, said recently.